Hey, you're listening to the Can You Kickstart podcast with Carl and Tom, the podcast where we delve deep into the projects of Kickstarter. Today, our special guest is Sandy.
Hello there.
Okay. Hiya. Can you tell us a bit about your project?
Certainly. It's called Cthulhu Wars. It is a large board game, including a number of huge plastic miniatures. It's got about, 11 or 12 days left to run. We're currently at about $750,000. We originally asked for $40,000, so we're pretty happy with the success.
Sweet, yeah. So congratulations, first off.
I'd say quite impressive. Near 2,000% over what you aimed for.
Yes. And it's all much quicker. We hope to get more than we aim for, but it's happened a lot faster than we expected, so we've been scrambling to catch up with rewards for the people who have put us there.
Great, yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about the game? Like, what's it about, the objectives?
Sure. Okay, so the game is a four-player game. Well, you can play it three up to five, but basically four-player, in which you play various factions of the Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos. So Cthulhu is kind of well-known on the internet now. He's one of the factions you play. Then there's three others like unto him. And so basically there are these alien gods and monsters that have come to Earth to destroy it, and you play the alien gods, and you're fighting over who gets to control the ruins of Earth. There's a large map of the Earth with different nations or different areas putting it, like there's Europe and South Asia and Africa and stuff. Then you move your armies around the Earth, opening up gates that will teleport in more of your creatures, and trying to capture your opponent's gates and kill their monsters so that you can win. Game takes about an hour and a half to play, up to 2 hours, and it's all pretty much a huge monster bash.
So it's a huge kind of RTS RPG kind of feel to it.
Yes, I mean it's turn based because it's hard to do RTS on a board game, but the turns are very quick. So when it's your turn, you do one action, like you might move one unit, or you might declare one battle, or you might summon one monster. Then it's the next person's turn, and it keeps racing around the board really fast. You never have to wait long for your turn, because I hate waiting. So I'm not a fan of.
I'm not a fan myself.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of queuing. You know, so.
Oh, we're English. Primary nature to complain in queues.
Mm. Okay.
Well, sir, how long has this been in development, and how long have you been with the idea?
Well, I sort of had the idea, or a related idea, last year when we put on a Kickstarter called Cthulhu World Combat, which is kind of the same theme, but it was based on an iPhone platform, and that was a humiliating, abject failure of a Kickstarter. We got like 5% of what we needed, and just like it bombed. So I said, you know, I still think this idea is good, but maybe iPhone is like the completely wrong platform. And plus, I've always really liked board games. And playing them, I got my start in tabletop games back in the 1980s. So I said, how about if I do a really cool tabletop game where you can actually physically handle the cool figures and play with them? Then I started designing that last November. I immediately started playing it with, you know, friends and family, and everyone liked it right off the bat. They said, this is a really fun game. And my friends and family aren't the kind that will pretend to like something to please me. They know that, I mean, they are perfectly willing to tell me something that's terrible. So I then started taking it out to other people in the spring, and they really liked it. And then I said, okay, this needs to go on a Kickstarter, and I think this is worth doing. And so it sort of evolved from the last game, but it's another try at it. But I think it's a better try at it, and it's a funner game, and that's where it all came from. I got together with two partners. One is more sort of the business guy. One is the artist who did all the art. If you've looked at the Kickstarter, you've seen all the amazing art in it. That's all Richard Long.
Yeah, it looks fantastic, some of that art.
He was a real find.
He was. Where did the original idea for the game come from?
Well, there's a lot of games based on Lovecraft. Lovecraft's an author from the 1920s and 30s who wrote really creepy horror stories. They've been made into movies by Stuart Gordon and Brian Yuzna, other Hollywood guys. And there's been a lot of games kind of based off his concepts. For example, Arkham Horror is a well-known game that's based off it. But all these games are kind of based on the idea that you're trying to stop these horrible monsters from coming back and conquering the world. So you're trying to close their entryways or put them back to sleep or kill their minions. Or like it's always reactive. They must be stopped. but I've always kind of been attracted to the idea, what if they weren't stopped? What if they came out and they got to play with all their toys? They got to have all their amazing powers that are only threatened or hinted at in the stories, but right? Because, you know, Cthulhu never actually comes back. He's only, you might see him for a second, and then he stopped. I said, let's bring him back. Let's give him all that cool stuff and let the players all have all these great monsters and magical spells and abilities and cultists worshipping them and all this stuff. And that's kind of where it came from, kind of an over-the-top sort of Cthulhu game, cutting right to the most exciting, gigantic part of it. That was what I thought. It's like, that's where it came from. I've always been fascinated with that idea, you know?
Yeah, it's quite impressive.
Yeah, it's a bit of a fresh perspective on it, really.
Yeah,
it is.
It's never been done before, so that's I don't know any other game where you play Cthulhu, so that's kind of a new thing. I mean, it's possible there's one out there, I just don't know one.
Well, I'll make three of us.
Yeah.
So, what kind of rewards are you offering for this Kickstarter?
Well, we are offering them, obviously, a copy of the game is the most obvious reward that you will get.
Yeah.
Then we have a number of expansions and add-ons for the game. New factions you can play, like the Opener of the Way or the Windwalker, and we've added new kind of maps you can play on. So instead of just playing on Earth, you can play on prehistoric Earth, or you can play on another planet. Okay, or you can play in the Dreamlands, a mystical dimension where you only go in your dreams. And so these are new; these kind of change the game out because you're playing on this new map. We've added so these are other things you can sign up for. And then we have some Kickstarter exclusives where we have like custom dice. Normally in the game, the magical gates the creatures come through are cardboard tokens, but we've made some plastic ones that are 3D and stand up, and your figures can sit on them. So those are kind of nice. That's a Kickstarter exclusive. And then we have a first turn marker, and normally the first turn marker is again a cardboard token you just take, and it's, I'm the first player. But we've made one that is a girl with tentacles, kind of grabbing her in a very tasteful way, as you can imagine. And and she's pointing with her finger at who the first player is, so you can use her. And then there's some custom dice, and now we've added in a new series of things where if we get a certain number of backers, then we'll unlock a special display figure of each of the creatures in the game. There's 17 different models of creatures in the game, plus there's another like 30 or 40 models of the add-ons, and we'll give you a free display model for every 100 people we get extra from what we have had on like a few weeks ago. So people are getting these free models. They're getting free new like outer god alien things. So it's actually has become a complicated enough Kickstarter that we're putting together a special like pledge manager so you can see exactly what you're getting and figure it out, because some of the levels you get the free stuff and some of the levels you get some free stuff and not all the free stuff, and it's I guess a lot of Kickstarter things go like that. But we're new to it, you know.
Yeah, I was looking through your page. You have come up with quite an interesting way for doing your rewards, having lists of backers and hitting money targets added on as you go.
Yeah, we thought that was kind of innovative. Normally it's always money targets, so we thought having numbers of backers would be cool. So you guys are probably more experienced in Kickstarter than we are. What do you think? You think that was a wise move on our part? Or?
Yeah,
I was quite impressed by it.
Okay.
I've never seen that before.
You put yourself a real hands out there. People know what they're aiming for. It gives people more incentive to put in.
And it's not just money-based either, right? It's just, if a whole bunch of guys pledge on to the lowest level, we still give them the free figures. So I think we're trying to
work with the people.
We're trying to be super proactive about this. There's only three of us, but we go on every day, and we're active in the comments column. I mean, right now we're up to 54 updates in the game, and we have 10 days to go, right? So that's a lot of updates. We're trying to be very communicative with the fans, and the fans have made suggestions that we have then adopted. We aren't, right? We don't view ourselves, this is kind of for them, you know? And we go on other forums too, but Kickstarter is, of course, the main focus, because that's where those guys have actually paid money, you know? So they're...
Well,
makes sense.
I was looking through your page earlier. You said you were trying to keep it down so your import charges are as low as possible.
Yes, and we're not sure how even to do that, because the EU customs services are a mystery to us humble Americans. If you have suggestions, I'd be thrilled to hear them.
Oh no, they're completely over my head too.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I guess they're all. I guess it's all about a whole bunch of guys in Brussels that figure it out, right?
Yeah, that's what they're paid to do.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's Oops, sorry. So what's your favorite aspect of the game then? Or what do you enjoy most?
The thing
about
I like the very most about the game is that each of the factions you play behave completely differently. It's a very asymmetrical game. It's the complete opposite of chess, where the only difference between the two sides is one of them moves first. In this, there's one faction, the Cthulhu faction is very combat-oriented. It has powerhouse monsters, has abilities that make it able to kill other guys in a fight, and then you have in opposition the Black Goat faction, and she isn't so much about combat. She spreads like an infection across the board in a huge pool of control and consolidation. When she reacts to other players, it's mostly at a distance by remote control, not by directly confronting them. Then there's the Yellow Sign, who his faction is kind of like this OCD, schizoid, paranoid thing that kind of wanders around the board following his own distant drummer. And as he does it, he's constantly interfering with other people, but he seems to be playing his own separate game. So all the interaction of these different styles is what I really like about the game.
Oh, that's really quite amazing. It's quite in-depth for a board game.
Well, yeah, I play some pretty in-depth board games since I wanted to be able to put a challenge up to them. But also, I don't like games. I mean, I'm an impatient kind of guy. So though I own games that take hours and hours to play, I prefer games I can do quick, you know, and where I don't have to wait for my turn. So this game, your turn is, you only have to wait like 30 seconds for your next turn, and the whole game is an hour and a half, 2 hours. So you can play it several times a night if you want. And I kind of go for I'm sort of an instant gratification kind of guy, you know. So I kind of tried to put that in the game.
I can't argue with that. Oh, 30 seconds for a round, that's pretty much, that's an awful lot of rounds.
Yeah. So, well, there's times where it'll be longer because they're doing a battle, and then that usually takes about a minute or two. But everyone's interested in the battle because, you know, you want to see who wins. Or then there's the cleanup phase in between rounds when you are, everyone's getting their power together, and then, so there's... But a typical game round might only be 30 seconds before it gets your turn again, you know? And then, you say, I move. Then the guy's, I'm moving, I'm summoning, I'm moving. And then it's back to you. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I'll do this. So it's pretty quick.
Well, I'm a fan of fast-paced games.
Yeah. Well, good.
So what kind of problems have you encountered whilst doing this, making a board game?
Well, one of the problems is that if you're doing a game which is asymmetrical like this, then it's really easy for the game to become unbalanced, right? Because if factions aren't the same and one of them's, for example, just simply better than the others, then you have a game that doesn't quite work ever. Like, everyone wants to play the better faction. And so that's one of the issues, trying to get enough playtesting out of the game and playing it and working on the factions so they're not just different and that they feel different, but that they, like... That none of them has a big edge over the others. They all have an equal chance to win when they're played correctly, right? So that's one of the features. Another giant challenge we had, frankly, is making these huge miniatures that we've got for it. You've seen the size of the game pieces, right? I mean, the biggest ones are like 8 inches tall. I've never seen a game piece bigger than them, or even as big. I mean, maybe there's a game out there with pieces that big. I don't know what it would be, you know. But physically building those and getting them and has been a challenge. But we've done it.
Cool. Sorry. Keep interrupting you now.
That's okay.
So you obviously got a few expansions. Are you planning any more expansions after the Kickstarter?
Well, I mean, expansions post-Kickstarter are kind of going to have to depend on how the game does in the stores, right? We have ideas for them that we'd like to do. During the Kickstarter, we can kind of do them because they're sort of being paid for by the Kickstarter people. When more people sign on, then we get enough money from the people who have supported us, and then, you know, when we get, like, kind of ahead of the curve on the money, then we can introduce a new expansion, right? Because each expansion requires, like, molding costs and tooling costs for making the new miniatures, and so we have to get a certain amount before we can add a new expansion. Well, that's all on the Kickstarter. You can see when you get that money and say, hey, now we can do a new expansion, let's do one. But when it's in the store, then you have to kind of wait for, in retail, you have to wait for the money to trickle in, and then when you get enough, then you say, okay, now let's do an expansion and hope it sells. So the Kickstarter is a real push to that, to get those expansions out early. It's been extremely helpful to us. And I think to the fans, because they get all this cool extra stuff, right?
Yeah, true,
oh, yeah,
true.
Definitely. How has the Kickstarter community treated you in your game?
Well, I think the Kickstarter community has treated us generally pretty positively. I mean, there's a lot of people who are really strong fans. I mean, I think there's always some people in Kickstarter that want, like, everything for nothing, you know, or that anything you do is bad. And there's always two or three people like that. You know, you guys are a bunch of greedheads. You know, give us more stuff for free. Lose money on the Kickstarter, right? But there's not very many of those in our Kickstarter. And one of the most gratifying things I've had is that when someone does post, you know, some kind of mild attack on us, then we sit back for a while, and then like we'll see five or six or seven or a dozen other Kickstarter supporters jump on the guy and say, no, they're doing great. Let them keep. That's really heartening, you know. So we don't have to defend ourselves because we have fans doing it for us. Because a lot of them see what we're trying to do and they understand it. You know, I get personal emails and personal contacts all the time saying, "Hey, Sandy, you know this guy that said that? Don't worry. There's like three of these guys. Don't worry about them. We're all behind you." So I love that. So I don't know if that's common to other Kickstarters, but if it is, then you know,
well, from what I've noticed, Kickstarter seems to have the exact same mentality the rest of the internet has. You got your good, you got your bad, and they'll pick what they will.
Well, I've spent a lot of time on the internet plugging the game ahead of time, and I think that the Kickstarter, my evaluation of this is that we have a much lower number of trolls and hostiles than the average internet site. So I don't know if that's the Kickstarter community or if that is this game's community, but either way, I'm happy for it.
It's understandable.
Cool. So why base a board game on Lovecraft?
Well, I got my starts with Lovecraft with sort of a tabletop role-playing. It was a role-playing game, not a board game, but, you know, it was Lovecraft-related. And then later on, I was involved with the first Arkham Horror board game. That was 1987, so it's embarrassingly long ago. I like board games. I like Lovecraft. To me, it seems like a natural fit, you know? And also, I look around, and I have a bunch of Lovecraft board games here on my shelf. But again, I didn't want to just do another Lovecraft board game because, although I love those, I wanted to have something that would be really different, that would stand out in a big way. And so the fact that in the other Lovecraft board games, it's all humans trying to stop the great old ones. So your characters are people like humans, like Monterey Jack or a professor of wisdom of something or an insurance salesman. Or those are the guys that are the main characters. So I said, you know, that's been done and it's been done really well. I don't need to do that anymore. I want to do something where it's completely the other way of looking at it. And that's so it's Lovecraft, but it's a very new perspective.
Cool.
That's what Lovecraft's always been about.
Yeah.
I mean, Lovecraft's really popular amongst people nowadays. I mean, why do you think that is?
I think because Lovecraft changed the nature of horror and horror movies and horror writing. Because what happened before Lovecraft came along, the way a horror movie or horror story worked was that you would have your people in the normal world, and then something bad would happen. Whether it's like a mad slasher or a ghost or a mad scientist making a monster, or something would happen that would intrude into the regular normal world and kind of upset it. And then at the end of the story, the intrusion goes away again and you're back to the regular normal world, right? And this is how Frankenstein works. That's how all the movies work, right? So what Lovecraft did was you're in your normal ordinary world and then there's this thing that appears to be an intrusion, but what happens when an encounter is that you find out that your normal, ordinary world was a complete lie, and that, in fact, this intrusion is the way the world really works, and everything you thought about the nature of reality and humanity's place in the universe and the cosmos is incorrect. And then, at the end of the story, whether or not you defeat the bad thing, you can't go home again. You can't go back to your normal mode of life. This is why the characters in Lovecraft stories often end up going insane or killing themselves, you know, because they're trapped in this new vision of reality that is not pleasant. And so that's what Lovecraft brings. And I think it especially is resonant today because our world this is hackneyed almost to say now because it's so widely known. Our world has been changing so much over the last, you know, 10, 20 years in really fundamental ways, and we don't know where those changes are going to end up, right? I mean, We don't know where the internet and free information is going to take us. Like, look at Kickstarter. This is a whole new way of doing business that didn't exist a few years ago. And it's probably going to – crowdfunding is probably going to change the nature of at least creative efforts in a huge, huge way. Right?
Well, yeah. Crowdfunding has been very helpful to you.
Oh, no, I'm not saying everything about our world is bad. Though that was kind of a Lovecraft thing, though, right? But the thing is that we live in an extremely unstable world. We don't know what the – like, if you talk to a person – I was talking to a friend of mine who writes novels for a living, and I don't know if he's correct now, but he says, I don't think any of the conventional publishing houses are going to be around in 5 years. You know, I don't think any of the bookstores are going to be – I don't know how books are going to still exist in some form, but it's going to be very different because of the advent of Kindle and other media, right? And you know, I mean, maybe he's right. So there's this thing that's been around since
the early days.
Well, yeah, since the early editors in the 1500s doing Mort d'Arthur, you know, and now all at once it's going to be a totally different thing, you know. So I mean, that's kind of it's scary, it's exciting, but it's scary. And so Lovecraft's approach to that, looking on it as a terror, kind of helps us see the fears that we have about that and confront them in a way that a conventional horror story can't. Because in a conventional horror story, at the end of it, like I said, you go back to your normal safe world, and that's not how our world works anymore. We don't go back to that. Like, you know, in World War II, you could defeat the bad guys, and then everything's good again, right? But now, like, the bad guys are way harder to define. You know, the conventional the bad guys that we had up to 1989, the Soviet Union, they're just gone, right? And there's new threats, there's new opportunities, and all this instability is, I think, I've kind of gone on to this for a long time, but that's where Lovecraft's strength comes in as a horror writer, is that he lets us confront that.
It's pretty deep. It's pretty deep.
So, over the years,
yeah.
How has Lovecraft worked into your other work?
I have been a Lovecraft fan since I was 8 years old, and he was almost impossible to find anywhere. My dad had this ancient tattered book, 20 years old, that I got from him that had some Lovecraft stories. And so, as a result, every game I've done, I've tried to sneak in a little reference to Lovecraft or his story somewhere. Sometimes that
really?
Oh, yes, everyone. And sometimes it's a really big reference, like if you've ever played the game Quake that I worked on.
I did.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Do you remember Shub-Niggurath, the final boss, and the Shambler, one of the monsters who's lightning bolts out of his belly? Almost all the monsters. Yeah, almost all those monsters were stolen from Lovecraft. Okay. On the other hand, if you play Age of Empires 3, The War Chiefs, which I also worked on, which is about the colonization of America, the only reference to Lovecraft I have there is that there's some Indian scouts you can get to help scout out your area, and occasionally, and the scouts are drawn from random tribes. Well, on the list of random tribes, one of the tribes is the Miskatonic tribe, which is a completely imaginary tribe that Lovecraft made up. one of my coworkers said, who's helping do the Indians, said, "Who's this Miskatonic tribe?" I said, "Oh, they're an obscure New England tribe. Don't worry about them." And he, okay, and so I got him in the game. You know, so that was a very minor Lovecraft reference, but it's there.
Well, that's dedication, sneaking it into everything.
Yeah. I was going to ask, how did you get into Lovecraft? But, you know, you just answered that.
Well, the way I got into it partly was, I mean, not only did I find that book when I was 8 years old, and I'd never read horror stories like this before. They just blew me away. They were so different, you know? And I mean, I didn't have nightmares about anyone else's writings, but Lovecraft I had nightmares about, right? So, which I liked at the time. So then, like, from the age of 12 to 14, I looked and sought and tried to find copies of his books, and you couldn't find them anywhere. This is in the 60s and early 70s, and they just weren't in print, you know. I found copies at the local library that I could check out for a few years until the library found out that these books were rare, and then they put them in the locked case because they were worth hundreds of dollars. I didn't know what I was checking them out, these $100 books. And, of course, $100 back in, like, 1970 is a lot of money. Finally, in 1973, Ballantine came out with a paperback edition. But Lovecraft was still pretty obscure. People hadn't heard about it. I recently went to a convention in Portland, Oregon, which was called CthulhuCon, which is a Lovecraft Film Festival. And the people there were nice enough to, what they said is that Lovecraft didn't really make it into the common consciousness until about 1980. And he said, there's two people that put it there, and they were nice enough to say that I was one of them. And because of the role-playing game Call of Cthulhu, that got people seeing Lovecraft. And the other was Stuart Gordon and Brian Yuzna, who did the film Reanimator, then they did From Beyond. They started making good movies about Lovecraft. There had been previous movies, but they were always, like nightmarishly, well, not nightmarishly, like, embarrassingly terrible movies. So the combination, I think, of the role-playing game becoming a hit and the movies being a hit, introducing other people to the Lovecrafting ideas of monsters and creatures, I think those two together is what spread the consciousness. Now Lovecraft's been in print ever since, and it's easy for people to find, and no one has to go on years-long quests to find the books like I did. But that's probably part of the reason I'm so hooked on them, is because I had to go on. I was like a Lovecraft character seeking out the mysterious tomes of ancient lore with the secrets man was not meant to know. You know?
My quest is never forgotten.
So you've obviously worked on Cthulhu games before. Is there anything that cross-references over to this board game?
You mean like the rules or something? Or what?
Yeah.
All the creatures and all the spells and all the gods are like right out of Lovecraft. I don't know if they come from the other Cthulhu games or if they come from Lovecraft, but there's kind of a big continuum there that's hard to distinguish. Some of the rules of the game actually come from other games that are not Lovecraft, like the power track we have I got from Chaos in the Old World, which is a game based in the Warhammer universe. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's from England, so
yeah,
I figure all you English guys know each other, and it's, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
In fact, speaking of which, I did want to say that... The sculpts of the models, the actual artists doing the sculptures, are based in England. Fenris Games is doing them.
Fenris Games.
No way.
So those are doing, and he's been on the interview talking about it. So he is our guy. And the thing is, since we were essentially penniless doing this Kickstarter, he agreed to do all the sculpts and like not get paid until we were paid on the Kickstarter. So that was, I mean, since he didn't know if the Kickstarter was going to see it or not, I thought that was pretty nice of him. So his reward is that he will be able to do the sculpts. Well, first of all, when we get the money, we'll pay him for having done the molds, right? And pay off his artists. Yeah. But also that he will then be able to sell the sculpts of the creatures made in fancy resin or metal versions to collectors. So if anyone wants to pay $100 for a really cool resin Cthulhu, he'll have that available.
Oh, wow.
Or I guess it wouldn't be $100, but like 60 pounds or whatever, right, it works out to.
I think it's about 60 pounds for us, yeah.
Close enough. But Lovecraft has been a pretty unique writer for years.
Yes.
Do you think another writer will come along and into the horror branch the way he has?
It's hard for someone else to open the door again once he's opened it. But that said, there are some other writers who are really, like, good in horror and write in a Lovecraftian way. J. Ramsey Campbell is one. Obviously, my brain's gone. The guy that wrote
I hate these moments.
Clive Barker has done good jobs on Lovecraftian sort of themes, right? And see, those guys are both from England too. Is something going on there that I should know about?
Yeah, we've got great writers.
Okay,
apparently.
Well, I was in the, but they're all like really creepy writers and like the creepy sculptors and the creepy writers and like all these terrible things. It's like there's some kind of dark heart of England that is being exposed here.
It's all the rain. It gives us brilliant inspiration.
Just one second. Can we pause this for just a second? I get a knock on my door. I don't know what it is.
Yep, no worries.
A second.
I'm going to talk to you while the podcast is still going.
Well, fair play.
So, if anyone wants to go and check out this Kickstarter, all you got to do is type in Cthulhu into Kickstarter.
I'm sorry about that. That was my son actually showing up. He's not cute and little, and he's like 30 years old. So you know, he has kids of his own. But here he is. So so anyway, back to the thing. Yeah, there are, like I said, it's hard to. I mean, once Lovecraft showed that you can have a really terrifying story by having the bounds of reality break down, then other guys can play off that theme, but until they come up with something else as new as him, you know, I mean, it's like once Einstein shows that everything is relative, then no one else can show everything's relative, right?
Well, it's true, you can't rediscover world ideas.
Exactly. So yeah, it's hard for someone to be as seminal as Lovecraft. Although another guy that was as important as Lovecraft, I would say, is Edgar Allan Poe. But, you know, who brought psychology into horror?
I did read something about a comparison between them earlier.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I would say that Poe.
I'm drawing a blank on that one.
I would say that Poe and Lovecraft each changed the realm of horror, like really profoundly, and that nowadays, like every horror movie, every horror story written is influenced by either Poe or Lovecraft or both. You know, maybe indirectly, maybe directly.
What do you view as these writers have added new dimensions to horror?
Well, what do you mean?
Like, they've taken what could have been a basic horror story and added, say, another layer on top.
Oh, I think that's great stuff. I love it. I own about 5,000, 6,000 DVDs, and probably like 3,000 of them are horror, so the horror is my life, right? Although I must admit, although I love my game Cthulhu Wars, it's not really horrifying to play because it's more like, it's kind of a, I hesitate to say it's a light strategy game because there's so many things you can, that ramifications when you're playing, but it is a very approachable strategy game, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so it's no one's frightened when, I mean, when someone brings out Cthulhu and goes on the board and I have Cthulhu now, no one is like physically afraid, but it's like, oh man, he's gonna come eat all my guys and
yeah. Well, at least once I'm gonna have to run screaming from the room when somebody does that.
So is it kind of like a tier system then, like you upgrade your troops kind of?
Yes, yeah. Each faction has several different kinds of, they have cultists and then they have monsters, then they have the great old one. And the Great Old One's kind of at the top of the tier, and then you have also these magical spells. I call them spell books, but really they're just effects that go on the game. Sometimes a spell book gives you a new ability only you can do. Sometimes it's some kind of ongoing effect. For example, there's this effect where the Crawling Chaos is one of the factions, right? And in the game, when you're pained in combat, you have to retreat out of the area into an adjacent area. Well, once the Crawling Chaos gets his Madness spellbook, he picks where you retreat. You don't anymore. So for the whole game, even if he's not in the fight, he's picking where everyone's retreating out of the fight. And so there's this constant, like, annoyance during the game of the Crawling Chaos retreating your units into the most awkward possible places when you have a fight. So that's kind of the, you know... That's the kind of thing that these do. Sometimes they'll give your monsters new abilities. Like Cthulhu has a monster called the Shoggoth, kind of a big amoeba blob monster, and it gets the ability. And one of its spellbooks gives it the power to absorb. And then when it goes into combat, he can eat one of his own allies to increase his combat powers.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So
you're like, so you see the, here's a Shoggoth, but he's got a bunch of food with him. They're gonna get.
Well, that's me. I'll always carry my food into war.
Yeah.
So is there anything you'd change about the game, or are you happy with how it turned out?
Okay, well, the thing is about the game, because it's not published yet, when I find things I'm not happy about, which I did just a couple weeks ago, that I'm actually able to still go in and change them. So, yeah, there's things I would change, and I've done it. So I'm still in that process. We're hoping to get it all settled down and rock solid. But the basic game is pretty solid. I haven't changed that for a long time. But the expansions and the add-ons, there's little things there I shift and shift and adjust. And so that's one of the joys of doing my own games, is that at some point I'll have to look back and say, oh, well, I wish I'd done this different. I hope I don't have to say that, but I will. But at the moment I'm still in the stage where, you know, I think I wish I'd done that different, and I will, right now. So,
it's one of the beautiful things about Kickstarter,
yes.
Really.
Yeah, because I don't have to give them. I mean, the game, like, I mean, I'm not going to change what the monsters look or anything. Those are like ideal for me. But if there's a rule that I find out in playtest tomorrow that is a little bit off or not fun enough or doesn't give people enough choices, then I'll change it.
On your website, you've got a download for the rules.
Yes.
Have any of your fans come back to you and said we'll create some balance?
No. They've come back and said that the way I wrote this rules paragraph was unclear or the organization of the rules needs improvement. And I agree with all that. I need to re-edit the rules. But they haven't noticed it. It's hard for them to notice an imbalance just by reading the rules. You actually have to play the game. And we've had enough people playing the game that they have not noticed imbalances between the factions. So that makes, I mean, they did it one time. I've been playing it for 8 months with three different playtest teams pretty heavily every week, every couple days a week. So when I was back in the video game industry, one of my tasks was to be in charge of balancing all these RTS games. You know, all the Ensemble Studios series of Age of Empires, Age of Mythology, Halo Wars, I was doing balance on all those. So I'm very experienced in balancing the game.
How do you approach a process like that? How do you start balancing games?
The the way I do it is I work out something that seems balanced on paper, and of course it never is, right? But it seems that way. And then I go in there and I make them play it, and I look for any moment in the game where something was awkward or where a person felt he had no choice. He said, I have to do X because Y just is an inferior choice. And then I go in there and I either make X less valuable or Y more valuable, so that now it becomes a choice. And if I see someone doing a little bit too good, I look for ways to either... Usually it's better to boost someone who's behind than handicap someone who's ahead, so that that way, instead of a player feeling like he's being hamstrung, another player feels like he's been boosted, you know? And so everyone kind of feels like the game's unfair in their behalf, and then that's where it's fun.
Okay. So you've obviously played a lot of board games before. Have you drew any inspiration from then to this game?
Absolutely. Let's see. I mean, there's a lot of games about area movement on the map where you have combat. So the games that do that, there's Eclipse is a game from Finland that does that. There's Small World. Not sure where that was designed, but it does that. Vinci, which I think is from Europe, originally published by Jules Descartes, who sadly passed away. Chaos in the Old World. Like I mentioned earlier, Chaos in the Old World, actually, I took the idea of the power track from them. I thought that was genius. Then the idea of having faction cards where each player has like a little heads-up display on the map which lists all the powers of his creatures and has a slot for keep track of his power and a place for all the spell books. And I got that from Twilight Imperium and other games like that. And so there's... I mean, if every game had to be developed completely from scratch, then there'd be absolutely no progress made, right? You have to build on previous stuff. It'd be like if no filmmaker was ever allowed to watch Hitchcock, then like how would that make their films better, right? You have to learn and grow. So that's what I did. Yeah, there's bits and pieces from other games in there that I think I've done a good job of making it all my own. And also there's the fact that the game is really strongly steeped in the theme. There's two different ways of doing a theme in a game. One is, as they put it, the tacked-on theme, where you have a cool game, then at the end you go, oh, we need a theme. Revolution! And they tack that theme on, or like, dragons! But really, the game has nothing to do with dragons or revolution. It's just, you know... this cool game. It could have any theme. And then there's and that, while those games can be fun to play, you know, like, you know, that's, it's just the theme doesn't make a difference to it. But this game, the theme is imbued throughout it, so that for example, when I'm going to add a new power in the game, instead of saying, well, let's see, what would be a fun power that would give the players interesting ideas, I kind of go around backwardsly and I say, what is a power that these monsters have in the stories? Right. So, for example, in one of the stories, you find out that there's these humans who are hybrids, whose in their ancestry are these awful things from beneath the sea. And so when they get older, they turn into these awful things from beneath the sea. There's a whole town full of monsters, but they look like humans until they get older, then they become monsters. So I gave the Cthulhu faction the devolve ability, which lets him turn his cultists into monsters, because that's from the story. And then in the game, this becomes a major factor in what he does, and of course I've adjusted the rules so it's easy, so it's balanced and it works well, right? But that came in later. But the original idea is like from the theme.
Cool. Oh,
that's cool. But you mentioned and clearly played quite a lot of board games. Do you think out of all the ones you've played, you could pick a favorite?
No.
Or one you'd recommend most?
No. I cannot do it. I can pick current ones that I like a lot. Let's see, we recently been playing Eclipse. We like that one quite a bit. My wife loves Ticket to Ride. We played that. My daughter-in-law really likes a game called Ghost Stories, another horror-themed game, but this time it's Chinese Ghost Stories. I'm looking at the map. What else do I like? Last Night on Earth is a really good zombie game. Triassic Terror is actually a Kickstarter game that I supported, and I got like a month after the Kickstarter closed. They must have already been in production or something, because that was so fast I couldn't believe it. And that's a fun, like, European kind of game about we have little plastic dinosaurs, and you're running around the map and eating other dinosaurs' herds. So that was entertaining. But picking one, I mean, when you're a real big board game fan like me, it's hard to have one, because there might be the one game that's my favorite this week. I played a bunch, and then I get sick of it, I would play something else. If I would say the games that have influenced me the very most over the history of my gaming, I would say that the most influential games were Cosmic Encounter from the 70s, which is the most asymmetrical game ever built. World in Flames, which is a game about World War II that covers the whole globe. It has China, it has America, it has Japan, it has the Romanians. I love that game. I play that almost every year. I say once a year because it takes months to finish, so maybe that's a problem. And let's see. I've probably done Dungeons & Dragons because I got my start doing role-playing games based on having first encountered that. So those are really influential games of mine.
Cool. So are those all source books then that I can see behind you? Or are those?
Oh, yes. Yes. Those are let me show you. So those are role-playing games and source books. And then over here are the board games. And they kind of go kind of fade off into the distance. See all those board
games? Whoa, that's a lot
of board
games.
Those are all board games. Those are all board games. And then if I go over like this, you will see the wall of DVDs.
Oh my, wow.
So this
that's,
is...
That's seriously impressive.
We actually had to have our house... When we built our house, we had to like pay extra to get it specially built to include the library. So so there's like... The wall of DVDs, the wall of games. So that, yeah, so you can see. I mean, I won't say I've played every single one of those board games, but I've probably played all but about, like, 10.
Wow.
So, now some of them I've played once and go, oh, okay, got it, and then I don't play that again. But a lot of them I play more than once. One of my favorites is actually called Britannia, for what it's worth. It's about, it was a game made by some British people who had been in school and the school teacher had boasted that Britain has never been successfully invaded since 1066. You know, you've probably heard that routine. And so he said, yeah, but before then it was invaded tons. So he made a whole game about all those other invasions, starting with the Romans, the Saxons, and all these guys. So it's a game all about conquering Britain. So it's a very entertaining game with the different player center.
Have to point out.
So it's actually kind of...
How many games do you think, yeah?
I have no idea. I mean, here, you can make a guess as good as me. What do you think? What's your guess?
I wouldn't.
1,000?
I'd say that'd just be the board games.
Yeah. It's mad.
But I don't have enough yet. There's games I need to go out and buy right now. It's an addiction. I can think of games. There's games I don't own that I want to get. Isn't that pathetic when I have all those games already? My wife says it's pathetic. But my defense is that, look, I live board games. It's, you know, this is what I do. This is my job. It's all tax deductible.
We all have our voices.
Yeah. Although one advantage of being a professional game designer is I actually get to deduct these things from my taxes, so.
Yeah, that's an advantage.
this is like heaven.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to pay the value for them, then the deduction is not the full value, but still, you know, sweet, huh?
Still, yeah. It's quite impressive. I've not seen anywhere near such a collection.
Well, tell you what, if you're ever down in Dallas, Texas, stop by, I'll make you play some of the games.
I'll keep you to that word.
Well,
yeah, man, 10 years down the line, we'll be like, yeah, show up.
I've done that before, so I promised someone that, and I hold to it. So we'll get you a nice Texas steak, too, mesquite grilled, so you can see what,
oh,
see
yeah.
what the real thing is like.
Looks like it's time to save up a bit.
So,
Well, yeah, goddamn.
So I'm coming up to the last of my questions now. So you obviously involved a lot in gaming.
Well, yeah.
And game development, obviously. So what advice would you give to people wanting to create their own board games?
Well, here's what I did on Cthulhu Wars and on Call of Cthulhu, which are my two most successful games. Instead of trying to figure out what the market would like and what people would enjoy, I said, I want to make the game that I want to play and the exact game that is the most fun for me with the pieces I want and the quality I want. And then my logic was this, that there would be enough other people there like me that they would like it too and buy it. Whereas I think if I'd gone for, I'm going to drink a game I think will appeal to the greatest number of people that I didn't like, I think that they would be able to sense that my heart wasn't in that game. In the computer game business, you can always tell when the team was forced to do a project as opposed to when they really wanted to do it, you know? And I think that's also true in the board games, and that's my advice. Make the game you wish to play.
That makes sense. Is that how you've worked to all your games?
No. So I have evidence that this way of doing it is smart.
Have you ever worked on a project that you thought was a complete failure?
Yes.
You got any details on that?
All right. This was a game called Darklands. It was a computer game from 1980 or 1991, and there was like it was the game was near its was supposed to be done, and one of the major flaws of the game is that it was completely not fun at all to play. And so they brought me on. They said, "Hey, Sandy, you know how to make things fun. Come on this game and make it fun." And so I got onto the game and tried to make it fun, but the project was already so dysfunctional. I mean, the lead artist wouldn't talk to the lead designer. The lead programmer was lying to other people about things, or not maybe not lying exactly, but like he was at odds with them. And so it was just a train wreck. And I tried to make it as much fun as I could, but you know, at one point, like all the leads walked into the office of our manager and said, "This game is not going to come out when you think it is. It's way behind schedule because everything is impossible to do." And he said, "No, it must come out at this time because we need it for our stock options." And they released it. And they released a game that crashed, a hard crash, back out to the desktop every single time you played it. That's what they put in the box.
Oh, wow.
You imagine how excited I was about that. Our playtest guy, our QA guy, he refused to sign off on it, right?
Oh, that's when you know a project failed. Mm-hmm.
And yet they still released it.
It wasn't my choice.
Like some companies, it's just pride.
Well, this is the company MicroProse Software, and you can see that what happened to them. So, they are.
Well, I've never heard of them. So, yeah,
they were back in the 80s, early 80s. I worked on the game Civilization with them, the original computer game. If you've heard of that one,
I've heard of the game. Played all the games.
Well, there you are. I've played Civilization is one of the games I worked on. Sid Meier did. And Bruce Shelley did way more work than I did, but I was on it a little bit. And that game, on the other hand, was like working out really well. You know, the playtesters would play this game after hours, and playtesters never do that. They're always so sick of the game, they go home. They don't want to play games at all. They want to watch a movie or something, right? Or yell at their wives. But these guys are playing the game, and let me tell you, Darklands did not have them playing the game after hours. You know.
Well, if it killed the desktop, I'm not surprised. I give up on games to do that a lot.
Yeah, well, you should. Well, we should have, eventually a patch was released where you could play it all the way through, and then people started, actually, it has fans today still that like bits of the game, but, you know, I'm always kind of surprised when I meet them, and I say, well, there is fun things about the game, but I'm so embarrassed by the fact we released it as this buggy, crash-ridden thing that it was you know, bad time.
It was a dark day.
Cool. Well, I'm out of questions, actually.
Yeah,
do you have anything, Tom?
No, I think I'm
okay. Good. Well, thanks so much for the chat, and I hope you guys have a chance to look us up on Kickstarter. We have 10 days left to go.
How do we get to your Kickstarter?
You go to Kickstarter.
The people listening.
Go to Kickstarter and search for Cthulhu Wars. CTHULHU. Space Wars. You can also find us on Board Game Geek. There's videos about us up on YouTube. Or just type Cthulhu Wars anywhere and you'll see probably a whole bunch of things. Kickstarter Cthulhu Wars will get you right there.
There'll also be a link to it in the description of this podcast as well. So
if you
just
want to look below. Yeah, we're actually one of the Kickstarter, the staff selections. So look under Board Games and you'll see us.
Excellent. Okay, I think that brings our podcast to an end.
Okay.
I think it does.
Well, thanks again for being on. It's been awesome chatting to you.
Hope you got what you needed.
Yeah, we did.
And more.
Okay.
This podcast usually goes up a couple of days after we've recorded
it. Okay, sweet. If you can send me an email when it goes up, and I'll put an update on the Kickstarter about it.
Yep, no problem.
Thanks. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.